History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. How deeply was the Confederate Secret Service involved in the plot to kill Abraham Lincoln? Did the Confederate Secret Service assassinate him? Well, some historians think there are strong indications it did, but oftentimes the facts uncovered in researching this question raise more questions than they answer. Strong indications point mostly to no. But sometimes the best way to explore unanswerable questions is with a counterfactual story or even outright fiction. Frequent guest Sandy Mitchum, who's the author of The Death of Hitler's War Machine and Bust Hell Wide Open, joins us again to discuss this topic by way of his new book, The Retribution Conspiracy. Sandy has couched his book in the form of a novel because there are some missing pieces, because it's hard to trace the detailed activities of a Secret Service 154 years after it ceased to exist. But the Confederate Secret Service still ranked up a number of accomplishments, and this is a very interesting way to explore this question. And also, if Lincoln were assassinated by the Confederacy, how would it have been done? So in this episode, we're going to be looking at issues like espionage, intelligence, and the covert means by which governments of the 19th century try to get dirty work done. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Sandy Mitchum. Sandy, welcome back to the show for the fifth appearance.
Well, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So if it reminds me of the Saturday Night Live skit with Tom Hanks, where he's the member of the Five Timers Club and there's an executive suite with an 80-degree pool and lobster dinner available and members with embroidered jackets. We don't have anything like that yet, but if my budget improves, I'll see what I can do the next go around. So your new book is very interesting, and it combines a lot of topics that have been popular on the show: the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, and intelligence networks and spycraft, and it all converges in here together. There are a lot of places we could start, but tell me about Confederate intelligence and Confederate spycraft. I don't know a lot about this, so can you tell me about how it was set up and what this world was like during the Civil War?
Well, there are a lot of pieces we can't put together. The Confederate Secret Service was very good. It had about 1,200 members. At least 600 of them spoke more than one language. They were very well educated. They were sophisticated. Most of them were rich. And they didn't mind spending money on the cause. They did some things that you can't trace, but that's to be expected. Because if you can trace the activities of a Secret Service 150 years after it ceases to exist, you don't have to ask, was it any good or not? You know it wasn't worth a hoot. We know that John Wilkes Booth was involved. They paid him $1,500 at one whack. That would be $40,000 in today's money. There were two other disbursements to him of $200 and $300, so it bring the total to $50,000 in today's money that we know about. John Surratt, the number two man in the conspiracy to kidnap Lincoln, was a courier for the Secret Service for 3 years. Lewis Powell, who was a member of the conspiracy, attempted to assassinate Secretary of State Seward at the same time Booth was assassinating Lincoln. And he came very close to killing him. He sliced him up so badly you could look at his cheek and see his tongue. He was sent to the Secret Service by John Singleton Mosby, the great ghost of the Confederacy, and reported to John Wilkes Booth. There were at least 9 members of the conspiracy put on trial. 8 of them were convicted. 4 of them were hanged. 3 of them got life sentences. So it was pretty deep. But one thing that alerted me to the fact that it was much deeper than people realize was Lewis Powell. They called him Lewis the Terrible. because in battle, he always shot to kill. He never shot to wound. He had no respect for human life, no value on it, and that included his own. Matter of fact, he carried the skull of a Union soldier in his knapsack and used it for an ashtray. On the last night of his life, he had befriended the Union Assistant Secretary of War, Thomas Eckert. And Eckert was leaving his cell, wished him well in the afterlife and so forth. And he stopped at the door and turned around and asked Powell, "Did we get them all?" Referring to the conspirators. And Powell laughed at him and said, "You ain't got half of us yet." Another piece of evidence occurred when Lincoln was assassinated, April 14, 1865. An actor with known Confederate sympathies walked into the presidential booth unopposed. And he was only armed with a single shot Derringer, 44 caliber, and a knife. And that tells you something. It tells you that he wasn't expecting any opposition, that Lincoln would not be guarded. Well, how would he know that? Obviously, he did. And he walked up within 4 feet of the president and blew away the left side of his skull. I think if he hadn't tripped over the regimental flag when he jumped from the presidential booth to the stage, I think he would have gotten away. It's certainly conceivable. Another thing that kind of tipped me off was occurred in 1923. Abraham Lincoln's only surviving son, Robert Todd Lincoln, he had a career as a bureaucrat and became Secretary of War under Presidents Garfield and Arthur. He was visited by two of his friends at his summer estate in Vermont. Horace Young was a golfing buddy, and Nicholas Murray Butler was the president of Columbia University. And they, to their horror, they found Robert Todd Lincoln was burning some of his father's papers and asked him, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "I'm doing it for the sake of history, because I have uncovered evidence of treason in my father's cabinet." And they implored him not to burn the papers. And he said, "Well, why shouldn't I burn them?" And they said, "Well, for the sake of history." And Robert Todd Lincoln says, "Yes, for the sake of history," and tossed another sheet of paper onto the flames. Who would in Lincoln's cabinet would commit treason? Well, the obvious candidate is Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War. We know he was ruthless, humorless. We know that he disliked Lincoln intensely. And we know he dabbled in the shady world of espionage and sabotage. I believe he was involved with it. There's just so many superficial evidences. For example, he got a hold of John Wilkes Booth's diary right after the assassination. And when he allowed Congress to examine it, 18 pages were missing. And Stanton said they were missing when he got them. But General Lawrence Baker, the head of the National Detective Police, said that was a lie. It was not true. And anyway, Stanton got the diary back and it disappeared altogether. They were clearly worried, some of the radicals, that Booth would strike at them from beyond the grave. This Lawrence Baker, General Baker, decided that Stanton was involved in the murder of Lincoln. He said so in letters to congressmen. And then he was shot at twice and slightly wounded. They tried to stab him. Four men attempted to abduct him. This all happened within 3 months. And get him in a carriage. That would have been the 19th century equivalent of a one-way ride. He fought him off. But then they found him dead in his apartment. And the cause of death was listed as meningitis, which meant in those days you had to put him in a sealed coffin and bury him immediately, and they did. But the family got his body exhumed, and the cause of death was actually arsenic poisoning, so he was murdered. Just things like that. On the last day of Abraham Lincoln's life, April 14th, 1865, he was concerned about his security. And he went to get a bodyguard, and he went to the War Department. The man he had in mind was Thomas Eckert. He was a big man, over 6 feet tall, at a time when the average man was about 5'7", and immensely strong. And Lincoln at one time had seen him break five iron bars over his own arm. And he was fiercely loyal to Lincoln. Had he been there as a bodyguard, there's no way John Wilkes Booth would have been successful. But Edwin Stanton said, no, I have important work for him to do tonight. You can't have him. He would not allow Lincoln to have Eckert. And 15 minutes after Lincoln left, Stanton said to Eckert, I won't need you anymore tonight. Go home. So he deliberately denied Lincoln a strong bodyguard. And later, Congress investigated Lincoln's assassination. Stanton said that last time he saw Lincoln was April 12th. And he lied to the papers as well, told the newspapers April 12th was the last time he'd seen Lincoln. Well, why would he lie? And why would he deny Lincoln a strong bodyguard? He also helped convince Ulysses S. Grant not to attend Ford's Theater that night, as he was originally supposed to do. Grant was security conscious, more so than Lincoln, much more so. He carried a bodyguard of strong Union combat veterans. Had they been present in Ford's Theater, of course, there's no way Booth could have gotten to the box. But they weren't. And Booth obviously knew it because, like I say, he showed up with a single-shot Derringer. And how did he know Grant wasn't going to be there? The newspapers had said he was. Just a lot of facts didn't align properly. For example, there was a Union veteran named Tanner. After Lincoln was shot, they took him to the Peterson house. He died. He was shot at 10:15. He died at about 7:20 the following morning. And Tanner had lost both his legs at the Second Manassas, and now he was a court stenographer. So they used him to record the testimony. And he said later that he had enough evidence in 15 minutes to hang John Wilkes Booth higher than Haman. But nevertheless, Stanton didn't send anybody after Booth or didn't even list Booth as a person of interest until 3:20 in the morning. He gave Booth a head start. Why? Well, you can draw your own conclusions. But at midnight, hours before he sent anybody after Booth, he ordered the arrest of John Surratt. He said he was the man that attempted to assassinate Secretary of State Seward. And of course, it wasn't him. It was Powell, who also went by the name of Lewis Payne. Why would he make that mistake? The two men looked nothing like each other. Powell was a big, strong, handsome man, and Surratt was not. And also, Surratt wasn't even in town. He was in Elmira, New York, heading for Canada because he signed up for a kidnapping, not a murder. And Howe you got to ask yourself, how did Secretary of War Stanton even know who John Surratt was? He was a member of the Confederate Secret Service, but did Stanton know that? And if he knew that, why didn't he have him arrested before Lincoln was assassinated? Anyway, they arrested Surratt's mother instead. She ran a safe house for the Confederate Secret Service.
Well, it's hard to untangle a lot of this because, as you said, we're dealing with espionage, and also these are records kept by a government which ceased to exist a long time ago. So it's not as if you can go into the Secret Service archives today. Before getting into the details of how you reconstruct your novel and take historical fact and then have to make decisions on how you think something would and wouldn't have played out and try to determine that, what that process is like, one thing I'm curious about is the approximately 1,500 members you mentioned that were part of this intelligence network, because this is at an interesting time in history for espionage. A century earlier, George Washington had the Culper spy ring, which was an informal group of people that happened to know one another. There, you could have a slave, you had a cabbage farmer, you had different people who happened to live on Long Island and were in close proximity to New York and could feed intelligence back to the Continental Army that way. And then if you jump two centuries ahead, you have World War II, where that Allied intelligence is completely professional. They're training people how to be a paratrooper, how to operate radios, code books, Morse code, everything else. So it goes from something that's very ad hoc two centuries ago to something that's professional two centuries later. What is it like in the 19th century? Are Confederates who happen to have a good network of relations recruited? They happen to know different languages, or is there a different training? What does the intelligence corps look like at this period?
Well, they were very intelligent people, but they were pretty much untrained. They did have their ciphers and their codes. They sent coded messages. And you've also got to remember that Washington, D.C. in 1861 was very much a Southern town. The police force was definitely pro-Southern. And I think they had the best spy of the war in Rose Greenhow. She was a Washington socialite. Her husband had been killed in an accident, and she was being courted by the head of the Senate Military Affairs Committee and another member of that committee. She was, when she was younger, they say she could walk down the street and cause carriage accidents. I've seen photographs of her in her 50s, and she wasn't hard to look at then. And she got the entire Union order of battle and battle plan for the first Battle of Bull Run. And she was a member of the Secret Service and sent it to General Beauregard and Jefferson Davis. So when the Union Army finally advanced on Bull Run Creek, they expected to find a Confederate army, but they found two of them. And Jefferson Davis later said Rose Greenhow won the Battle of Bull Run for the South. Rose was later killed in 1864 while on a mission for the Secret Service. So you had some pretty sharp people. That was one of the sub-themes of the novel. Many people looked have accepted the myth that the Confederate Army and the Confederacy was pretty much a bunch of illiterate hillbillies led by a few West Point stalwarts. But that isn't true. Now, it's true the literacy rate in the South was less than New England, but it was 97% in New England. It was 92.5% in the South, so it was pretty close. England at that time had a literacy rate of 75%, and the South had a higher literacy rate than any country in Europe except Sweden and Denmark. And I wanted to bring that out too. There were some pretty sharp characters in the Secret Service, and not so much in the North, because they early in the war, they hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency. as their military intelligence agency. It was a private enterprise operation. They had no military background, hardly. And they grossly overestimated Confederate numbers. The Battle of 7 Days, for example, the Yankees thought they were outnumbered 2-1, when actually the Confederates were outnumbered almost 2-1. So Union intelligence didn't really catch up until roughly the last few months of the war.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. That is a thing that with disproportionate force, good intelligence like that makes a tremendous difference, as we've seen in many times in World War II and different battles that happen. So now I'd like to get into your story, how you put it together, and feel free to divulge as much as you care to without giving it all away. Because this issue of a historical novel, I find it very intriguing. I've read a few different ones, and when you're writing history and you're missing a lot of key facts, sometimes historians will just zoom out until they can write what they do know. So if, for me as an Ottoman historian, we have no written source from the time of the first Sultan, Osman. So if you're going to write about him, you have to zoom out and then maybe find archaeological evidence or the wider civilization he's a part of. And you can say with certainty, and then you make educated guesses about him. But historical novels that do fill in the gaps, some of them are really illuminating. One of my favorite is Dan Simmons' The Terror, which has to do with the lost Franklin expedition of the 1850s from Great Britain that tried to discover the Northwest Passage. You can see all the research in the book where the types of tools used at that time for a polar expedition, the way people speak, the Victorian voices are perfect and everything else. It really gets you a sense that you're stepping into that world. And he does, I think, a very good job of guessing what would have happened, except for the supernatural elements, of course. But for your book, please discuss with me, what were the facts that you had? When did you fill in the blanks? And what was the process by which you chose to fill in the blanks?
Well, I've given you some of the facts, and let's call those facts dots. If you're writing history, you've got to connect the dots with historic facts. The alternative, there are two alternatives to that. One is to use apparently, obviously, it appears, maybe this happened, that sort of thing. And if you have too many of those, you've got a clumsy book, in my opinion. And sometimes that's unavoidable, but with some books and some subjects. But novels are governed by their own rules. If you've got two dots and you can't connect them, just go ahead and connect them yourself. And that's basically what I did. I made up the difference between the two, and I believe these things actually happened. Can't prove it. But like I say, it's listed as fiction, so you don't have to in a novel. For example, why didn't they kill Vice President Johnson? Well, that's known. George Azarote decided he didn't want to take part in a murder, and he went to the bar and had a drink. Didn't stop him from being hanged later, but... He chickened out. But according to one witness, Johnson was in the Kirkwood Hotel, room 68, asleep. And they tried the door, and it was unlocked. And apparently there was some scurrying around, like not a big man scurrying around, but maybe a 100-pound woman. And my speculation is that it was Ella Starr. She was one of the many women in love with John Wilkes Booth. She was a 19-year-old prostitute, vivacious, attractive, pretty smart. And I think John Wilkes Booth sent her to seduce the vice president. And then... after he fell asleep, unlocked the door. And that would explain a lot. I mean, if you were vice president of the United States and fooling around with your wife in a hotel room, wouldn't you lock the door? But we can't run that down because Ella Starr was one of the people that disappeared shortly after the assassination. I think Stanton made several people disappear. But that, I hope that answers your question.
Well, John Wilkes Booth, of course, is an important, if not one of the most important parts of this story. And I've had different authors on who had different takes on him. One author wrote a book called The Lady Killer Who Killed Lincoln, who gets into John Wilkes Booth's syphilis, as you mentioned. He had many paramours. And this author thought that it was that and the erratic nature of his later writings that suggest he was deranged, and this is what led him to assassinate Lincoln. Not part of any grander plan, and he wasn't operating with lucidity or with his right mind. What's your take on that? I suppose there's a lot of discussion about John Wilkes Booth himself, and with divulging as much as you can, how did he appear in your book?
Now, John Wilkes Booth was definitely a Confederate sympathizer. He didn't join the Confederate Army because he promised his mother he wouldn't. At least that's what he said. But I think he felt guilty over that. And I don't think he was crazy, but I think he deluded himself into believing the South still had a chance. After Appomattox, it did not. And it's easy to condemn him for that. But put yourself in his place. He was a very passionate young man, 26 years old, no military or general staff training. And when Lee surrendered, that eliminated only 1/6 of the Confederate Army, and Lincoln was assassinated 5 days later. It would be easy for him to convince himself the South still had a chance of independence. And I think that's what he did. It was not clear on April 14th that Appomattox would effectively end the war. It did, but I can understand why he wouldn't think it did. I rather think he did it among his last words after he'd been mortally wounded, tell my mother I died for my country. I think he believed that. I think he thought he was carrying out a patriotic act, and also think he thought he'd be praised for it. He got to see some newspapers a few days before his death, and he was being condemned North and South, and he was upset and astonished because thought he had done something heroic.
Well, you mentioned earlier that what you're trying to do with the story is show that the Confederacy had a robust intelligence network, and which is indicative of the general level of education that existed there, contrary to belief that everyone except for officers were literate. Are there any other things from your book that, as you wrote, points you were trying to make about history that you'd like to share?
Well, antebellum Southern culture is pretty well misunderstood. You know, people watch television and they see the Wild West and they assume the Western culture evolved in the West somehow. It didn't. The cattle culture didn't originate in the West. It moved West. I can show you colonial records from South Carolina that talk about roundups and rustling and cattle drives and branding. Also, gunfights in the street, vigilantes. I mean, Nathan Bedford Forrest, famous Confederate general, killed his first man in a gunfight in the streets of Horatio, Mississippi. Hernando, Mississippi. And the Old South cattle culture had everything the Old West did, except the Spanish saddle horn. It was a frontier culture. And although the South is not associated with the frontier culture, some leading Southerners were, you know, people like Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, Jim Bowie, just to mention the more prominent ones. And I wanted to give them a deeper understanding of the Southern culture. You know, this Gone with the Wind is accurate. I mean, it's true. They did have a plantation culture and economy, but what it doesn't point out is the people that lived in the big house didn't start out there. Many of them started out picking their own cotton. Then they acquired slaves and continued to pick their own cotton for a while till they became prosperous. It was an evolutionary thing. And that's normal. I mean, higher order economics tend to replace lower level economics, even today. So the cotton plantation was much more profitable than driving cattle. And it largely replaced the cattle culture. But that frontier mindset was still there. And the hero of my book is a fictional man named Colonel Rance Lieber. He still had a frontier mentality, as did many Southerners. And he ends up shooting people in duels, and or at least one, and I don't want to give too much away about Liebert, but there was a thin veneer of civilization there, but underneath it, there was this frontier mentality, and you can see that, like in the case of General Earl Van Dorn. He was assassinated by someone named Dr. Peters for violating the sanctity of his home. And I made a mistake in one of my books. I wrote a book on Nathan Bedford Forrest, and I accepted the story that's been accepted for 150 years that he was shot because he was fooling around with Peter's wife. But I kind of wondered about it because she was an infomaniac. And if he'd shot everybody that fooled around with her, he would have been a mass murderer. And a friend of mine, Professor Bridget Smith from Holmes College up in Mississippi, wrote a book, and she uncovered the truth. Peters didn't shoot Van Dorn because he was fooling around with his wife. He shot him because he was fooling around with Peter's 14-year-old daughter. And you know, he didn't go to the judge advocate general or the governor or have Van Dorn prosecuted. He just went in and shot him in the back of the head. And that's sort of the frontier mentality. Handle your problems yourself. And Peters made good his escape. Later was captured, put on trial, and the defense attorney and Peters and prosecutor were called to the judge's chamber. And after that meeting, the judge dismissed the case. Obviously, they told the judge what really happened, and he didn't want to embarrass the Confederacy by having a trial and admitting the true reason Van Dorn was shot. Incidentally, the 14-year-old girl was pregnant. That is just a microcosm of the antebellum South's a lot more complicated than a lot of people realize. And I think that's because of this undercurrent of the frontier culture. It was still there.
Well, something I would like to wrap up on is what you just mentioned there of trying to understand antebellum culture on its own terms and looking at things through the perspective of people who live there at that time, seeing different possible futures like we do today in our own lives and doing the best to navigate them, not knowing what the future will be. We understand with history that when we look back, people then didn't know what was going to happen. We know that, of course, but it's subconsciously, it's hard even for professional historians not to fall into the presentism trap of seeing what will happen as inevitable in a predetermined course, or not understanding, like you said, that the South in the 1850s, early 1860s, in many ways, was still a frontier culture and had those hallmarks. And it's not as if this only came into being in the 1870s, 1880s, and different territories. And by 1805, 1810, the Deep South was completely settled and the institutions were completely fleshed out. That wasn't the thing. Are there any other cases like that of trying to avoid presentism in your book, where you're looking at things through this perspective of the people who live there with different possibilities and different futures, that you think gets into the mind and gets into the eyes of somebody who was living in the antebellum South or during the Civil War?
I try to. One thing that I tried to do in this book was talk about the importance of women. Their role is not understood. The term Ole Miss referred to the senior woman on the plantation. She ran the economy of the Confederate South while the men were off fighting. And she's never been appreciated fully. But it hadn't been for her, the Confederate war economy would have collapsed long before the Union Army arrived. And I made one of the major players a woman, because they were often major players. I mentioned Rose Greenhow. She contributed more to the Confederate cause than thousands of men did. I came up with an actress named Guinevere Spring, and I think she was one of the more interesting characters because it does show the importance of women in not only the war effort, but the spy business. Women make much better spies than men because men are attracted to women. And in those days, the mentality of women was not fully appreciated by many men. They didn't think they were as intelligent as they actually are. And they tended to underestimate them, and they would say things that they shouldn't. And I bring out the Dahlgren raid. The South knew it was coming. And that was because of female spies. And they tipped off Richmond. And Dahlgren actually captured a plantation, and everything I wrote about that was true. It was run by Sally Sidon, the wife of the Confederate Secretary of War, and they intended to burn it. And when the Yankees came up, she sent a messenger to Richmond to tell them where they were. And then she, Colonel Dahlgren came up, and he was intending to order her to leave the house so they could burn it. And he told her his name, and she said, are you any kin to Ulrich Dahlgren? I said, well, yes, that's my father. Yes, he was one of my beaux back in Philadelphia, and I was a little bit jealous when he married your mother. And she totally captivated him. They went in, drank a bottle of wine. He staggered to his horse. She delayed the whole raid 2 hours. Huh. And tipped Richmond off to the fact they were coming. And Jefferson Davis later declared she was the savior of Richmond. Huh. And they didn't burn her house. So, you know, they were pretty sharp. Colonel Dahlgren had no chance against Mississippi.
All right. Well, this is a unconventional, but I think very useful approach to a part of history that many don't know about, but is really interesting and useful to uncover. The name of the book is The Retribution Conspiracy, The Rise of the Confederate Secret Service. Sandy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.